One of the most enigmatic and controversial figures of the 19th century is the abolitionist John Brown. There's no doubt he was on the right side of history. He dedicated his life, in fact, sacrificed it, trying to end slavery. But he murdered people along the way, including 5 unarmed men in Kansas in 1856. So what should we make of John Brown today? Over the years, Steve Paulson has put that question to a number of writers and historians, and he's still mulling over what they've told him.
John Brown may well be the most fascinating character in American history. He was a religious fundamentalist, a self-styled prophet so convinced of his own righteousness that he butchered men in cold blood, a man so extreme in his convictions that doctors today would surely try to medicate him. And yet he was absolutely right on the one great issue of his day, slavery. It's no wonder John Brown has been irresistible catnip for a host of historians and biographers, and writers like Russell Banks, whose novel Cloud Splitter is narrated by John Brown's son, Owen.
Was my father mad? I realize it is the only question that can matter to you. More than the facts of my father's hectic life, people do need to know if he was sane or not. For if he was sane, then terrible things about race and human nature, especially here in North America, are true.
Russell Banks immersed himself in the life and deeds of John Brown and came away an admirer.
I consider him the way Malcolm X considered him, the way James Baldwin and W.E.B. Du Bois considered him. I consider him a hero. I'm perfectly aware of the fact that he was probably a man with a disordered personality, but so is General Patton.
In the mid-90s, Bruce Olds wrote his own novel about John Brown called Raising Holy Hell.
There's no question that he operated from a certain moral high ground. It's why he's fascinating. To be able to behave so dastardly, but yet to have a system of belief so unyielding and so crystalline is what makes him an enigma. Why, I might ask him if he was here, and he'd probably be unable to answer, or he'd spout scripture at me. Why were you the only colorblind white man of the 19th century? Why?
John Brown was one of the very few white men in the 1850s willing to kill to end slavery. So was he an American hero?
No. No, he wasn't an American hero. He was a heroic character. He was fearless. He was dedicated. But Brown speaks to our despair.
Princeton historian Sean Wilentz.
He doesn't speak to our hope. He speaks to us in times when the possibilities for political change, for political improvement, seem to be shut down. So he speaks to pessimism. You know, he speaks to the idea that we have to rise up in arms against the United States Constitution. We can't solve our problems any other way.
Who was John Brown? If you want to pin a medical label on him, you'd probably call him obsessive compulsive. He was a strict Calvinist, a man steeped in the Old Testament God of wrath and revelation. He also had, by all accounts, remarkable willpower. Here's Bruce Olds' fictional rendition of John Brown.
He radiated a cold-blooded quality remarked upon by everyone with whom he came into close contact. People noticed an inexplicable nip in the air when he was nearby. He gave the reptilian impression of being cool to the touch. He took his nightly baths in a horse trough heaped with chunk ice. He could hold the palm of his hand in a candle flame for 9 seconds without flinching. He could wake a napping dog with a steady gaze and shoo a cat from a room with a sharp glance. He liked to catch hornets with his hands and pop them into his mouth like peanuts before spitting them out in mid-flight.
What's hard to understand today is how unusual John Brown was for a white man of his time. As biographer David Reynolds points out, even Abraham Lincoln didn't believe in equal rights for blacks and whites.
He was, until about the second year of the war, an ardent colonizationist who believed that because blacks and whites could not live on equal terms in America, that blacks should be freed, emancipated, and then shipped abroad. And basically, Harriet Beecher Stowe, another great anti-slavery figure, says the same thing at the end of Uncle Tom's Cabin. Let's get rid of the blacks. John Brown wanted exactly the opposite. He wanted blacks to be integrated into American society, to live on exactly equal terms, no difference between blacks and whites.
The most notorious episode in John Brown's life took place in Kansas in 1856. Brown and his private militia dragged 5 unarmed men out of their houses during the night and hacked them to pieces with swords. This slaughter, on the face of it, is impossible to justify. It's why so many people still condemn John Brown. And yet, as David Reynolds says, there was a context to those killings. At the time, Kansas teetered between becoming a free state or a slave state, and violence was rampant, with most of the killing done by pro-slavery ruffians.
There's a reason it was called Bleeding Kansas. There were murders, there were skirmishes, there were battles. It was shortly after one particularly bad situation in which the anti-slavery capital of Lawrence was completely burned and ruined by drunken pro-slavery hordes that John Brown went on his a murder spree. But I will mention one thing, is that some people say, well, if he had jet airplanes, he'd fly them into buildings. No, not at all. He was very selective. In fact, when he went to those cabins on Pottawatomie Creek in Kansas, yes, his men slaughtered five people. These were known pro-slavery politicos. John Brown did not touch their children, did not touch their wives. And I'll say another thing, that of the 36 murders committed between 1855 and 1858 in Kansas, 28 of those were by the pro-slavery side.
John Brown's terror spree made him a feared figure in the South. Ironically, it was Southerners who most admired his courage. Sure, they hated him, but he also triggered their worst fears. He was a battle-tested warrior who would do anything to end slavery. At one point, he even rode into Missouri, liberated 24 slaves, and carried them off to Canada. Above all, Brown wanted to spark a slave uprising. That's what he tried to do in 1859 with his assault on the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry, Virginia. He sent word out to slaves at nearby plantations, but none would join him. Inexplicably, Brown and his band of 21 men waited and waited until they were cornered and killed or captured. So what was he waiting for? Novelist Russell Banks.
It seems as though one of the things he was waiting for was what in fact happened, to be captured and to be martyred for the cause, for the cry to go up across the land, south and north, that the north was invading the south and the slaves were about to rebel. Basically, he split the clouds that surrounded the whole issue of slavery at the time.
Tightened down the barrel of his 45, John Brown waited for the slaves to rise. With his long, sharp rifles and his navy coat, he's gonna be the leader of a slave revolt. He preached abolition like the fires of hell, but you can't give freedom to someone else. There's soldiers at the door and they're breaking it down. It's the end of the journey for old John Brown.
The raid on Harper's Ferry was a military disaster, and it did nothing to liberate nearby slaves. But there's a great irony to the story. John Brown left his mark on history precisely because of his failure. After he was captured and before he was hanged, Brown, from his prison cell, spoke eloquently against slavery. Biographer David Reynolds.
What happened is that when he was in prison, his letters, his speeches to the court, just galvanized people in the North. So the people like Ralph Waldo Emerson, the intellectual leader of the nation, said, when John Brown is executed, he will make the gallows as glorious as the cross. And this comparison of John Brown to Jesus Christ galvanized the South by making it hate the North all the more. The speech to the Virginia court, Ralph Waldo Emerson said, there are only two good speeches in American history, the Gettysburg Address and John Brown's speech to the Virginia court.
And wasn't it Thoreau who said that it was words, not rifles, that were John Brown's great
weapon?
Yeah,
he said John Brown did nothing with his rifles. It was his words. And all of these letters were about how he was actually looking forward to die for the nearly 4 million enslaved blacks in America. And when people heard that, they were kind of stunned.
So the irony is that it was really because of his military failure, the fact that he was captured and later executed. I mean, that allowed him to become a martyr.
That's what really rallied his cause. He should have been killed because the guy that stabbed him when he was captured stabbed him at least six times in very, very bad areas of the body, but had accidentally brought his dress saber, not his military sword, along. He should have been killed, and if he had been killed, it would have been just a little temporary flare-up. Everyone would have realized he didn't have much backing or whatever in the North. And then I don't think that he would have helped to spark the Civil War that much. I really don't.
David Reynolds' book is called John Brown Abolitionist, The Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and Ceded Civil Rights. Those are large claims to make on behalf of this one man. But Reynolds makes this argument. John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry polarized the North and South. and had the unintended effect of helping Lincoln win the presidency. Harper's Ferry cast such a cloud over the abolitionist cause that it squashed the hopes of the radical Republican candidates, allowing the more moderate Lincoln to grab the nomination. So against all odds, Lincoln became president, prompting the South to secede, which plunged the nation into civil war. Exactly what John Brown had wanted all along, a war to end slavery. So, did he spark the Civil War?
I don't think that John Brown was as important as many people think he was.
Historian Sean Wilentz.
Look, I mean, what John Brown saw the Civil War as being was an insurrection of slaves in the South. That didn't happen, and it wasn't going to happen. But in the South, understand, if any Republican was elected in 1860, secession was going to occur. So, as I say, to credit John Brown with Abraham Lincoln is a pretty perverse formulation, although you can see it paradoxically working out.
Unless you're willing to go with sort of the power of irony and how things might not play out as you intended, but the results in the end might actually be very close to what you would hope for.
Historically, yes. No. If you step back from it and you have a fine taste for irony and paradox, which is all throughout American history, absolutely. But whether that makes John Brown a great and honorable man on that account is another matter.
John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. His soul goes marching on.
So what should we make of John Brown today? Was he a hero despite his murderous rampage? Novelist Marilyn Robinson thinks so. John Brown figures prominently in her Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Gilead.
I, for example, think that John Brown ought not to have such a bad reputation. You know, I mean, the fact that Jesse James is treated as a folk hero and John Brown, abolitionists are still treated as if they were fanatics. And look what they were doing. I mean, people that are pro-slavery are treated as the reasonable ones, you know?
Really? You think so?
Yes, by comparison with the abolitionists. Yes, I do. Hmm. And I mean, if John Brown was violent, what was slavery?
John Brown's legacy is full of ironies. Some of his greatest admirers have been virulent racists, including Lincoln's assassin, John Wilkes Booth. Sarah Vowell wrote about Booth in her book Assassination Vacation.
The great hero of Booth's life was an abolitionist, and it was John Brown, and Booth was so obsessed with John Brown.
Because John Brown was willing to kill a lot of people for his cause?
Yes, not because he wanted to end slavery, but because he was willing to kill and die for his cause, and Booth admired that to the extent that in 1859, when the government executed Brown for his terrorist activity at Harper's Ferry, Booth, who was a young actor in Richmond, knew that a Richmond regiment was going up to witness Brown's execution, and Booth begged to go with them, bought himself a uniform, and then went up there so he could watch Brown be executed. And Booth called Brown, you know, the greatest hero of the 19th century.
In our own time, John Brown has had other unlikely admirers on the radical right, including Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh and Paul Hill, the killer of abortion doctors.
I think that's a kind of American archetype.
Novelist Russell Banks.
Where religion and politics and belief in higher law and belief in justice cross, there violence usually takes place.
It all raises a troubling question about John Brown's legacy. Even if you think he was justified in killing pro-slavery advocates, is he to some degree responsible for these later terrorists? On this question, you'll still get plenty of disagreement. On one side is David Reynolds.
Well, I think there's a test. Timothy McVeigh was an anarchist. Osama bin Laden is a Muslim fanatic. All these people are very narrow. John Brown was an ardent Calvinist. And yet, who are his closest followers? African-Americans, atheists, agnostics, Jews. People have completely different opinions from his. Why? He was an American.
I don't think there is such a thing as a good terrorist.
Historian Sean Wilentz.
You know, terrorism has a great effect on the terrorist. And if you've committed acts of terrorism, I think it involves a moral hardening, which cannot be easily put away.
Steve Paulson produced our story about John Brown.